Alan Guth is our guest, and he is talking about how he got scooped in the particle physics business, the cosmology business, which, of course, is one of those great life lessons of, well, I didn't get that one. What's next? So, Alan, what was next?
Henry and I started trying to figure out if there was any way that we could make cosmology consistent with grand unified theories. Grand unified theories were acquiring quite a bit of momentum then, so it would have been sad to see them die because they conflicted with cosmology, or sad to see the standard cosmology go out the window with people scratching their heads about what to do next. So, what we realized, I need to take a bit of a step back here. The magnetic monopoles would have been produced in a phase transition that these grand unified theories predicted should have happened in the early universe. Now, by phase transition, I should maybe clarify that all I'm talking about is a situation where the behavior of matter changes suddenly as the temperature changes, like when water turns to ice or something like that. In this case, the phase transition is rather central to the behavior of these grand unified theories. As the name implies, the theories describe the interactions of nature as being unified. Essentially, everything is the same, with the exception of gravity, which is left out altogether for now. And the way the theories work is at very high temperatures, this unity is apparent. At very high temperatures, there really would be, according to grand unified theories, no discernible difference whatever between, for example, an electron or a neutrino or a quark. They would all behave absolutely identically at very high temperatures, according to grand unified theories. But then as the temperature cools, there's this phase transition, and all the differences that we see between the different interactions and these different kinds of particles become apparent in the cold temperature phase, the low temperature phase. And it's at this phase transition that the magnetic monopoles would be produced. We were assuming, as was John Preskill, that when the temperature for the phase transition was reached, the phase transition would happen right away, the way phase transitions usually work. When you cool water, when you reach the temperature of ice, it turns to ice, normally. But if you cool water carefully enough, you can, in fact, cool it below the normal freezing point without it turning to ice. And that's called supercooling. And what Henry and I realized is that if supercooling occurred at the phase transition of the grand unified theories, that could suppress the production of these magnetic monopoles. And Henry and I published a paper together explaining all this. And while we were writing that paper up, I'm quite sure that Henry suggested to me that maybe I should rethink the assumption that we were making that this supercooling had no effect on the expansion rate of the universe. We were thinking about how the supercooling would behave, but we were thinking about it in the background of an expanding universe that we just assumed kept on expanding the same way as it would have otherwise. So I followed Henry's advice and went home one night and wrote down the equations that described how the expansion of the universe was affected by other things, and discovered that the effect of the supercooling would be fantastic. It would create a gravitational repulsion, exactly the gravitational repulsion of inflation that I was talking about earlier, that would send the universe off into a period of enormously rapid expansion, completely changing everything. And the same night I discovered that, I realized it would solve one of the outstanding problems of standard cosmology, something that's usually called the flatness problem. This flatness problem I had learned about more or less accidentally a year earlier from a lecture I attended given by Bob Dickey from Princeton. Dickey had pointed out that in the standard Big Bang theory, in order to make the theory work, you had to assume that the mass density of the early universe was extraordinarily close to this value called the critical density. The reason basically was that today we know the universe is within a factor of 3 or 5 of this critical density. And it turns out that the evolution always carries the universe further away from the critical density, wherever it starts. So to be anywhere in this ballpark that we know we're in today, within a factor of 3 or 5 of the critical density, at, for example, 1 second after the Big Bang, the universe must have had a mass density equal to this critical density to an accuracy of 15 decimal places. And there was never any explanation in the standard Big Bang theory. It just had to start out that way or it wouldn't work, but there was no reason why it started out that way. It turned out that in this rapid expansion that I discovered in this one spectacular night, the expansion actually creates matter as it expands and creates it in just the right way so that as the expansion proceeds, it gets closer and closer to the critical density.
Which gets closer and closer to where we ended up.
That's right. Closer and closer to where we know, in fact, we ended up. That's right. So suddenly we had an explanation as to how the universe got there.
Which also makes you feel better to know that you are where you are as opposed to some other place. And that, that is part of the struggle you were trying to reconcile.
Well, let me, for those of us who can just hold on real tight and listen and follow you, let me also say, if people really are interested in the in your arguments in this, you have done the unbelievable. You have written a book about all of these things with nary a, not a single equation included. Part of what I'm hearing you say, and think I found in your book, is that, in fact, you can create something from nothing.
That's right. Because as this expansion proceeds, the mass density, in fact, approaches a constant value. It does not thin out as the expansion proceeds the way any normal substance would. So you really are creating something from nothing. Of course, I learned about conservation of energy when I took my basic physics courses, just like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So it all has to fit together with that in a peculiar way, and it does. The big loophole in the notion of conservation of energy, and it's a loophole that was known for a long time by some people, but never fully appreciated by most physicists, the big loophole is that there's such a thing as negative energy. And in particular, the energy associated with a gravitational field is negative. So if we look at the universe that we live in, there's, of course, a tremendous amount of positive energy.
Yeah, you're the guy who started this conversation telling me that, that gravitation was always positive.
That's right. Under normal circumstances.
And that it didn't matter.
Right.
at least in most.
That's right.
This is the revised version.
That's right. The revised version is that gravitation is almost always attractive, but there are a few peculiar states of matter that actually create a gravitational repulsion, and that is crucially important because that's what inflation is all about. And in terms of energy, if we look around the universe today, there's a colossal amount of positive energy in the form of the stars and galaxies and planets and us. All matter is equivalent to energy, E equals MC squared, if I could use one equation on radio. I figure that's not really an
equation. We can relate to that one. I found that in the concrete. I know that one.
That's right. Everybody knows that.
Well, but I doubt seriously that those of us who know it know it. Hmm. I don't think we have a clue what it means. And that is what you are talking about, is that that reflects, if I understand you correctly, that reflects what we see and feel and observe, yes?
Yes, that's right.
Which is why
that's
we care about that particular equation.
Well, that mass and energy are just variations on a theme.
That's right. Mass and energy are variations on a theme. I think
that's
the right way to describe in words what that equation
means. That's not intuitively obvious.
Well, no, it's not. That's why Einstein won the Nobel Prize.
That's why we quote him a lot, isn't it?
That's right. But anyway, mass is equivalent to energy. It really is just two different names for the same thing. So all of the mass that we see in the form of stars and galaxies, et cetera, amount to a colossal amount of energy. But the catch is that the universe also contains vast amounts of space with gravitational fields by which all this matter is attracting all the other matter. And those gravitational fields contain negative energy. And it really does work out that the total energy of the universe is consistent with being precisely zero. The negative contributions from gravity, for all we can measure, are consistent with canceling the positive contributions coming from all the stars and galaxies.
This goes back to the two things. I think a lot of us wonder what physicists do.
Yes, we do.
Particularly theoretical physicists, at least experimental physicists, you know, they have buildings and machines and devices and things. That all this came together to me.
In your head,
it seems to me to be an extraordinary representation of that. But it also goes to the earlier question about mathematics, because what I'm hearing you say is that, and you referred to it, you know, as I worked through the equations.
Right.
What happened in that weekend? What did you do?
Okay. What I did is actually, from the standards of theoretical physicists, rather simple. I took the equations from Einstein's theory of general relativity, which general relativity is a theory of gravity and it's a theory of space-time. It describes gravity as a twisting or bending of space-time itself. And it's the framework that's always used in cosmology these days. All of cosmology since the time of Einstein has been phrased in the language of Einstein's general relativity. So I took a fairly standard set of equations that you can look up in any cosmology book, which come from Einstein's general relativity, and I put on the right-hand side of those equations features that I knew about from particle physics that describe this unusual state of matter that I was exploring, this extremely supercooled state, and discovered that once you did that, the equations in a very simple way led to colossal expansion. The technical word is exponential expansion, and that actually has a fairly simple meaning. It just means that there's a certain time during which the size of the universe would double, and if you waited that time again, it would double again, and waited the same amount of time, it would double again. And this doubling and redoubling doesn't take very much, only about 100 or so doublings, to start with something much smaller than a proton and produce something that's big enough to encompass the entire observed universe.
We're going to come back with Alan Guth, who is going to tell us how you get from something the size of a proton to the entire observable universe in a very short period of time. We'll be away a short period of time. We'll be right back. Bill Russell and I are at MIT, and we hope that you'll be with us when we return.